Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to this fifth session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. Those of you who have been attending have met BL. Brett is not with us today, I think he's traveling. Both of these individuals have made themselves indispensable to the Moria Federation, a lot of hours behind the scenes and in running these webinars. So a big thanks to you both. BL, would you be so kind as to review the GoToMeeting interface?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Okay. If you have a question for us, you know, Francis has a lot of material, and you can ask questions during the presentation, and sorry about the phone, folks. And you can also type us, you know, you can raise your hand and ask a question, or you can type a question right here in the question block. It should be down under the list of attendees. Okay? If you can't see the block where you type it in, you should have a plus sign, and you just hit that. Yeah, you hit that until it's a minus sign, and then you'll have it. Okay, go to the next one, please. All right. And here's how you raise your hand. You raise your hand with the little see the little hand there with the green arrow raising your hand. If the arrow is pointed up in green, then it means you have the opportunity to raise it. If it's pointed down in red, then it means it's up and you have the opportunity to put it down. Okay? Also, please keep yourself on mute. You have the little speaker there that's a little bit underneath the hand. Right there by your name. We have a lot of feedback if too many mics are open, and so we keep all the mics muted until we specifically call on you. And after we've done that, if we forget to mute it, please make sure you mute it. If you hear any background noise, check your mute to make sure that that's it, because sometimes that will stop the background noise. Okay? Ready for you, Francis.
Okay. All right, I've received a couple of requests from attendees. One was that we intensify our focus on how each symbol and geometric form specifically relates to the unfoldment of higher consciousness, you know, how we can use these forms to progress on the path. So I will in future be including how each symbol or geometric form indicates the path towards greater awareness, much as we did when we considered the S-curve of the yin-yang symbol. In fact, this request has inspired me to adapt a well-known geometric symbol in such a way that it symbolizes the great invocation. We'll explore this in the second half of the webinar. Okay, we have looked at the diameter, which is the geometrical symbol for the number 2, and ended our last session with a consideration of pi, the transrational function associated with the number 2. Pi mathematically reveals the relationship between the unmanifest and the manifest, between unity and duality, as represented by the circle and the diameter of that circle. So the C here is the circumference of the circle divided by the diameter equals pi. Okay. The circle with a point at its center represents the unmanifested absolute, which not only includes all subsequent diversity within itself, but also stands in a causal relationship to that diversity. The diameter represents the sum total of this diversity, but in its unmanifested or potential state. As we discovered last month in the Secret Doctrine, pi is the one in relationship to the 3, the 1, the 4, the 1, and the 5, the twice 7. Which stanza 4, verse 3 of the stanzas of Zan tells us is personified by the essences, the flames, the elements, the builders, the numbers, the arupa, which means formless, the rupa, which means form-bearing, and the force of divine man. We're going to spend a bit more time on this revelatory verse because it reveals qualities concerning the phohatic nature of Pi that, at least to my knowledge, no other teaching does. And Pi is, save the unknown transrational function associated with the number one, the highest of these phohatic functions because it is the energetic means by which the first differentiation takes place, by which the unmanifest moves into the realm of time and space. Okay, first of all, there are five numbers in the numbers that represent pi, which are 31415, and five types of personifications given us by HPB, the essences, the flames, the builders, the elements, and the numbers. HPB suggests that these five are divided into two categories, the arupa, or formless, and the rupa, or form-bearing. The formless and form size can be seen as the twice seven, one a causal and one and a manifest seven. This concept is found in ancient Egyptian theology, as well as in stanza 3, verse 4, which you'll see down at the bottom of the slide there. Then the three fall into the four, right? The radiant essence becomes seven inside and seven outside. We could hypothesize that the ones in 31415 represent the formless, and that the 3, 4, and 5 represent the form side. Well, for you geometry students, 3, 4, and 5 will probably bring up this idea. As you may remember, they are the elements of the Pythagorean triangle, and have a Sat-Chit-Ananda relationship of spirit form and the consciousness that connects form with spirit. This relationship is borne out mathematically, but we'll save an analysis of the Pythagorean triangle for another webinar. So, out of this list of five, the most likely candidates for the form list, and the ones, by the way, that she mentions first, represented by the ones in 31415 would seem to be the essences and the flames. So I went on a search to see what the esotericists has had to say about these two qualities. DK describes the essences as the central spark of life that lies in a causal relationship to every manifested form. More specifically, he speaks of, quote, seven lords which form the essence or centers in the body of the cosmic lord called in the occult books Phohat. Phohat, we have hypothesized, manifests through the transrational functions like Pi. In fact, this is strongly confirmed by this verse in the Secret Doctrine. So if we relate the seven centers of Phohat with seven transrational functions, known by science as irrational functions. I find calling them irrational functions very irrational because they're actually beyond the rational rather than other than rational. Anyway, we could further surmise that the essences are the life aspect of each of these functions. And interestingly, the ones often appear in these numbers. This gives us a whole new perspective on, for instance, the life of Pi. We find a description of HPB's other arupic element, the flames, in this old commentary from the Raves and Initiations. Let's bring an audience member, an attendee member, in to read this. Even though it's short, I'd like to hear some voice besides my own here. Do we have a volunteer?
I'm looking for hands and don't see any yet.
No.
Here we go.
Okay.
Go ahead, please, Scott.
Okay. Naught is left save flame primordial. That flame absorbs, revolves, receives, and remains. When all that has traversed the flame, then time is not.
Thank you. So we can at least hypothesize that the essences and the flames give us the two ones in our 3-1-4-1-5. So now let's move on to the rupic or form-bearing numbers. We're told in the second stanza in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, this is a whole different set of stanzas of Zan that appear at the beginning of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, another fabulous group for aficionados of the old commentary, that the builders, quote, built in many spheres, beginning with a third, unquote. This suggests, this was in the second stanza, and it describes the process of manifestation, basically. So this suggests that the third, or atmic plane, which is associated with the third aspect of intelligent activity, is where the builders initiate the response to the will of God. This seems a rational placement, as the builders are natural agents for the carrying out of the form-building third aspect of deity. Thus, we can pencil in the builders as representative of our first number in the 3-1-4-1-5. Now, what do the builders work with? The four elements, right? Fire, air, water, and earth, considered subjectively. So this gives us our third number, the number 4. How do the builders work with these elements? Through Fohat, or the transrational function of numbers. So we have 3 associated with the builders, 4 with the elements, which leaves 5. But why would 5 be associated with the numbers? I hypothesize, put forward, that it's because 5 is a manifestation of phi, which is the law by which the natural world comes into form, from sunflowers to galaxies throughout the universe. It is this law of 5 or phi or numbers that the builders, the 3, using the 4 elements, employ to create the diameter, the symbol for all manifestation. Indeed, the builders, or prajapatis, as they are called in the Eastern tradition, are most certainly great cosmic deva lords, wielding the law of number to mold the elements, or elemental kingdom, into that which we know as the form world. We've talked before about the connection between 2 and 5. Perhaps this verse gets to the heart of the matter, for it is phi, or 5, in the hands of the builders that manifests the potential represented by the diameter. So, if we unscramble the order in which HPB presents the personifications, we have 1, the absolute, made manifest through 3, the builders, 1, the essences, 4, the elements, 1, the flames, and 5, the numbers. Now, this is just an educated guess, but we know that builders working with the elements through the law of number is how manifestation comes about, and that manifestation as potential is the traditional meaning associated with the diameter. Consider the radical implications of this verse. For instance, it confirms and upholds our base 10 method of using numbers, suggesting that it is applicable even on cosmic levels, right? I mean, if we were using a base 12, these numbers would not be the same numbers. So it suggests something quite permanent and true about our base 10 method of using numbers. But more importantly, we discover that pi is only exoterically a relational fraction, right, 1 to 3.1415. Esoterically, at least according to the secret doctrine, its mathematical architecture holds hidden within it an entire hierarchy of beings and phohatic forces, which together represent the unmanifest or absolute in relation to all that forms the manifested universe. Geometrically summarized by the circle divided into two parts by the diameter. The screen that I had up as you came onto the webinar, the first screen, described the quality of this division. Okay. Remember the list of Sanskrit words whose every other letter was A? Note the similarity between the construction of these words and the 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5. It's interesting to note that the Sanskrit word Ananta, which means infinite, is also a name for Vishnu, Hindu lord of the second aspect, represented by the diameter. Thus, Ananta bridges the unmanifest, because it's a word that means the infinite, and the manifest, because it's a word that is applied to Vishnu. And in that way, it's a kind of a name version of the 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5. So you're looking at a personification of the diameter. Note that Ananta has six letters, three of which are A. 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5 has six numbers, three of which are 1. There's also another six-letter word punctuated by A's. It's Ananda, which means the bliss gained by union with the absolute, a subjective description of the relationship between 1 and 3, 1, 4, 1, 5. So Ananda describes the cosmic reality. Ananda describes the path to union with the absolute. And both can be effectively symbolized by the circle and the diameter. Therefore, by this series of numbers. Okay, if 1 to 31415 is the numerical code for a hierarchy of beings and forces, what about 1 to 1.618, the number associated with phi? We're not told as much, but how could these numbers not also esoterically represent a hierarchy of beings and forces, considering that phi is a manifesting agent of pi? It's interesting to place these two sets of numbers in sequence. First pi, 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, then phi, 1, 6, 1, 8, giving us 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 1, 6, 1, 8. Two sets of five numbers, the ones arupic or formless, the 3, 4, 5, 6, and 8 rupic. 3 plus 4 equals 7, 6 plus 8 twice 7. With 5, the source of phi and representing the hierarchy called numbers standing at the midway point, representing both the final number of pi and the source of that which follows. If we look at these 10 numbers as a tetractys, we see that these numbers naturally arrange themselves into three divisions. The one unmanifest at the pyramidion, because it's the one that precedes the 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, so it is the absolute. It's, that's a given. Pi, or 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, in the center two tiers, representing potential manifestation, and phi making up the base, thus representing the manifested world. So you have that unknown transrational function in the number one, at the absolute, and then we have the transrational function of pi followed by the transrational function phi. The second and third, let's see, the first tier is the source of all number, the one unmanifest. The second and third tiers represent duality through pi and add to twice 7. This is the transrational function of the number 2. The third tier represents phi, the manifesting agent of pi. So do you see this relationship? As you come down towards the base, you're moving from the unmanifest to the manifest. The numbers of this tier add to 16, the numbers of the bottom tier add to 16, which reduces to 7, which might represent the seventh or physical subplane. And it also is 4 times 4, which represents the cube of space. So any way you cut it, that bottom layer numerically represents the manifest realm. Note, too, that the 1 stands both at the top and at the center of the pyramid. And finally, kind of icing on the cake, the 31 of the second tier is the sum total of all the numbers. Now, let's begin our transition from 2 to 3 by taking a look at one of the most profound and ancient geometrical figures in sacred geometry, the Vesicapices, called in Italy the Mandorla. But before we do this, I'd like to open the floor because we're moving on in subject matter now. So does anybody have any thoughts, questions about this verse from the Secret Doctrine? Any ideas come to mind concerning this?
No hands yet, and I see no comments yet.
Okay, well, if you do, feel free to raise your hand and we'll call on you. This figure is formed by the intersection of two circles with the same radius, which cross in such a way that the center of each circle lies on the perimeter of the other. The Vesicapices is perhaps the most potent of all geometrical figures for symbolizing the transition from two-ness, represented by the two circles, to three-ness, represented by the three areas formed by the intersection of these two circles. If you have a compass, this figure is super easy to create. Just draw a circle, then put the point of your compass anywhere on the perimeter of that circle, and draw another. Philosophically, the Vesicapices comes into being when the point at the center of the original circle extends itself from that center to its perimeter, thus becoming the radius. This can be seen as a geometrical metaphor for the event described in stanza 3, verse 3 in the Secret Doctrine, namely the dropping of the non-eternal germ from the eternal egg, thereby creating duality in the realm of time and space. When, to continue this metaphor, the radius reaches the perimeter of the initial circle, it generates a new circle, which is, as DK says, a manifestation of the urge of the one life. The second circle is matter, or mother, the most primordial representation of the divine feminine. An appropriate image to contemplate on this last day of Virgo. Most of the great cathedrals of Europe built between the 10th and 13th centuries were dedicated to the Virgin Mother. In fact, the placement of these cathedrals throughout the cities of Europe mirrors the placement of the stars in the constellation of Virgo. From the perspective of sacred number and geometry, the mathematical properties of the Vesicapices, also called the mandorla because of its almond shape, bring forth 4 transrational or phohatic functions, pi and the square roots of the numbers 2, 3, and 5. And it also bursts the first series of polygons from the triangle to the decagon. So the Vesicapices is a natural cornucopia, a cosmic generator of diversity, from which emerges both the blueprints and the phohatic animating energies for the building of the form world. Now, it's not the only geometrical figure through which one or more of these phohatic functions manifest, but it's the only one that, at least that I know of, through which they all manifest. Okay, though every geometrical figure, including the Vesa Capices, has a specific energetic configuration and resulting potency, each of these figures is also universally applicable. In other words, geometrical figures have no subjective bias and thus always stand in a causal relationship to any particular use they may be put to, no matter how well that use may fit the figure, right? So we can subjectively apply the Vesa Capices to any specific instance wherein the energies of the figure are relative to that specific instance. For instance, at its simplest level of application, the Vesa Capices could be used to illustrate the traditional family unit of father, mother, and child, but could just as easily be used to describe a scientist who, through the use of his instruments, creates some result. Any two polarities that combine to create a result utilize the primary, but not the only, function of the Vesa Capices. I use the Vesa Capices conceptually in this piece entitled Chrysalis. It represents certain aspects of Pisces, which also means fish. It's basically the same root. Okay, we'll get back to the Vesa Capices in a moment. I want to develop another line of thought, then we'll bring the two together. We've talked about the illusion and subsequent glamour of polarized thinking. But actually, excuse me while I take a drink. But actually, the most dominant illusory aspect of duality is the pervasive experience of viewing life in terms of sequence, as a process of moving from point A to point B, the result of living in a time-space continuum. And in a single life, the longest of these A to B sequences is birth to death, fractally mirrored by thousands of waking and sleeping sequences. Within each waking sequence, we think, talk, walk, cook, eat, work, play, and read sequentially. Even now in this webinar, we are considering our subject matter in this way. Sequence is all pervasive, but is nonetheless illusory in nature because it fragments and thus tends to hide from us our perception of the whole. Consider, for example, a road. We think of roads as moving from point A to B, but in fact, origin and destination are subjective projections. Roads, obviously, don't go anywhere. They just are. If we could but realize it, this is true of life as well. It's a little harder to realize that with life than it is with a road, though, isn't it? Life just is. Destination is a subjective projection, just as surely in life as it is when traveling on the road. Sequential thinking is a result of the third aspect of divinity, that of active intelligence, which is, you know, one of the great triumphs of duality, you might say. And this is usually characterized by doing, even if that doing is just thinking sequentially. Though the habit of seeing life in terms of sequence is overwhelmingly prevalent, there are ways to catch a glimpse of the realm of synthesis, perhaps most effectively through meditation. But even in meditation, we may, for instance, consider an inspiring passage sequentially, and then reflect on it sequentially. This is because sequence determines the nature of our thinking, which is reflected in language, both written and spoken. In fact, language codifies the illusion of the time-space continuum. But there is a language, known as Sinzar, that breaks the linear approach to thinking by revealing its meaning synthetically rather than sequentially. It does this by using pictographs rather than words. Conceptually, something like petroglyphs, but infinitely more refined. Also, Chinese characters have some of this quality. Perhaps the best source of what Sinzar might actually be like comes to us from the last section of the Treatise on Cosmic Fire, wherein Dwal Kul describes the symbols of the seven cosmic paths. For instance, the symbol for path number one, the path of Earth's service, is described as a green dragon issuing from the center of a blazing sun. Behind the sun and overtopping it can be seen two pillars on either side of a closed door. The point is that Sinzar, and to a lesser degree the exoteric symbols and geometric forms that we know, can be apprehended synthetically rather than sequentially. I'd like to try an exercise. If you would bear with me, right now close your eyes for a moment and imagine your life synthetically as having, for instance, a single geometric shape, emitting a particular note or chord, and colored in some specific way. If you'd like, you can use words to describe this synthetic geometric metaphor, but make sure that the words apply to your whole life. Take a few seconds now to do this. We're just going to take 10 seconds. Try to visualize a geometric form that symbolizes your entire life. Okay, I'd love to go around and get to hear everybody's experience on this. If you did have an interesting experience, you're always free to email me, even if you'd just like to start up a conversation about anything connected with sacred geometry. I'm always open to responding to those emails. DK tells us each life that the personality leads is, at the close, represented by some geometrical figure, some utilization of the lines of the cube, and their demonstration in a form of some kind. I find this particular sentence very interesting. It's the lines of the cube as opposed to the cube itself. It suggests that they have different qualities. It's almost as though the cube represents incarnation. You know, you're in the cube of space, time and space. But how those the lines that make up that cube arrange themselves depends on the nature of your life. Anyway, he goes on to say, intricate and uncertain in outline and crude in design are the forms of the earlier lives. Definite and clear in outline are the forms built by the average advanced man of this generation. Fascinating quote. Okay, now let's bring the Vesica pieces back into the mix. I'd like to dedicate this portion of the webinar to Nancy and Martin Seifer. I want to thank you for your helpful suggestions. Okay, one day while reading about the Great Invocation, I was struck by the statement that it had been particularly difficult for those charged with the task to translate it into words. As we know, it is written as it appears here. But we have to ask ourselves, is a sequence of words the optimal way to gain an understanding of this invocation? Or was it originally a pictograph, possibly even a Sinzar character translated into the languages of the world? Evidence of the latter is suggested by a comment from the Tibetan in A Treatise on White Magic. He says, speaking of future times, the written word will not be needed, for men will use symbols of light and color to supplement through the eye what the subjective hearing has recorded. This set me to wondering what symbol of light and color might be used to supplement our understanding of the great invocation. Of course, the challenge was and is to choose or create a symbol that can provide additional insight through its geometry and color, and most importantly, express the meaning of the invocation synthetically rather than sequentially. After some preliminary experiments, like this one, I began exploring the best Capices. I'd like to walk you through my process of discovery. Just remember that this isn't the meaning of the best Capices, but rather just one way to make use of the energies afforded by this figure. We'll begin constructing our geometrical metaphor for the great invocation by assigning O, the first letter of the Om, to the circle on the left, and the M to the circle on the right. We'll be sounding the Om together. As we sound the O, visualize the circle on the left. Then as we sound the M, visualize the circle on the right, but without losing with your subjective hearing. Remember, DK was talking about subjective hearing. The sound of the O. Sound this with me now as you visualize in your mind's eye the two circles. As we chant together the O, visualize the first circle, and then as we move to the M, visualize the second circle and experience their interrelation. Okay. Where these two circles overlap, a third aspect of divinity, the realm of the Son of Mind, who is also the Son of God, comes into form, resulting in the Vescapices. This trinity is not dissimilar to that expressed right at the top of this chart, which illustrates our planetary hierarchy. It's from a treatise on cosmic fire. Somebody's done a nice color job on it. Specifically in the arrangement of the intersecting circles just below the solar logos. The point is that the second aspect stands at the height and in the center, very probably because this is the second solar system of three. So we'll apply this to the Vesa Capices by placing the department of the Manu, expressing the first ray of power and will, on the left. By the way, the red used here is not the red of the first ray. My opinion is that red is not something that we can register with our eyes at this time and won't be able to until the next solar system. So it's a kind of a stand-in red, just to give the chart a sense of the nature of the first ray. Okay, we'll apply in the central area, which is the Vescapices proper, this represents the hierarchy headed by the Christ, expressing the second ray of love wisdom. And the area to the right represents the department of the Lord of Civilization, expressing the third ray of active intelligence. Now, when we connect the central points of both the primary circles with the topmost point of their intersection, a perfect equilateral triangle comes into form, which is the first manifestation of a polygon. We'll assign the three aspects of light, love, and will in accordance with their originating points. Will on the left, light on the right, and love is the topmost point. Light is the most tenuous form of matter and is connected to intelligent activity through the light of the mind. So we now have geometrically assigned points for the three aspects of divinity as they appear in the great invocation. But we need a fourth point, described in the invocation as the center, which is called the race of men. We'll assign this center to the lowest point in the Vesica species, and when we connect that point to the point which represents deity on the left and matter on the right, we have another perfect equilateral triangle, but this one is inverted. We see this inverted arrangement in the 10th sephiroth of the Tree of Life, right there at the bottom, called Malkuth, which represents the earth. In both cases, they are a part of the sacred geometry of the entirety. They don't stand outside of that, which is actually the hope of humankind. Okay, so taken together, this diamond-shaped figure represents, at least within our metaphor, the sons of mine who choose to be the sons of men, that's a lower point, and yet for all eternity remain the sons of God, as it is stated in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. Okay, now let's start applying the words of the Great Invocation to what we've created thus far. The first section reads, from the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. This light of the mind, which is recorded in Greek mythology as the gift of fire from Prometheus, is the primary agent used to become one with the soul. Or as DK says, the light of matter, the light of the mind, and the light of the soul as a channel for the intuition are consciously blended, fused, and focused. In order to find the point of origin for the transrational function that represents life, light, we'll divide the Vesica species proper into seven equal levels, representing the seven subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. This is also the realm of the endeavor for the disciple, right? If you actually travel counterclockwise around the Vesica species, from average advanced humanity into the light, or the third aspect, the higher levels of the mental plane, into the Buddhic levels of love, and then around and to the level of will. Okay. The Fohatic function will choose to express the streaming forth of light is the square root of 5, which interestingly originates at the base of the fifth subplane when counting upwards. This third subplane, when counting downwards, the Atmic plane, is where the four lesser rays blend with the third major ray. So you can say it really is the expression of the third activity of active intelligence and the highest expression of light par excellence, this third subplane of the cosmic physical plane. Okay, now comes an essential step in our attempt to create a synthetic, Fohatically charged geometric figure that represents the great invocation. You know, if this is going to work, we must, after studying the relationship between the first section of the Great Invocation and the geometry we've chosen to represent it, merge these two in our understanding. In other words, the line representing the square root of 5, which is 5, which is related to phi, it's actually 1 plus the square root of 5 divided by 2. But this is the line of Fohatic energy. As well as its origin and destination, must invoke the meaning of the first section of the invocation without the presence of the words. Unless we infuse the geometry with this meaning, we can't really integrate the symbol with this invocation. You see how that works? As long as we stay with the sequential worded form, we cannot have a synthetic experience of the entire invocation, or even of the of each of the segments of that invocation. But we're aided in the translation by the fact that the line used to represent the words is charged by the phi-determined angle at which it descends, thus enabling the meaning behind the words, what DK called subjective hearing, to express its phatically charged nature. I mean, how many times has DK told us that words actually blind us to the nature that they're trying to, in fact, express? Well, symbols are one step closer to that truth. And one of the reasons for that is that they offer the possibility of a synthetic experience. This is an important point, and one that must be borne in mind when we're creating and using symbols. Since our symbols carry the phatic energy of the concepts they represent, because their component shapes and angles are the paths of least resistance for the phatic energy that they're carrying. Nothing in these symbols is non-essential or merely decorative. By the way, the word that activates the phatic principle throughout the great invocation is let. Let light stream forth. Let lightlets descend. Let love descend. This is an invocative word and is thus the active principle throughout the great invocation. Okay. Now let's move on to section two. From the point of light within the heart of God, let's bring it up here. Let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. This point of love is, in our geometric metaphor, the point where the circles representing the father and the mother aspects have their highest connection, thus representing the birth of the son. See it there at the very top. Let's draw a connecting line between this point and the point that represents humanity. The connection between the Christ and the vesica piscis is a hallmark of the Piscean Age, demonstrated by the fact that the Christ appeared within the vesica piscis above the entrance of many European cathedrals built between the 10th and the 13th centuries. Crowned through his identification with the father aspect, the will aspect, yet wearing the mantle of matter, he stands at the portal between two worlds, represented by the two curves of the vesica piscis, because they belong to father and the mother aspect, respectively. By placing the figure above their cathedral doors, the master architects, who were invariably initiates of the Masonic mysteries, seem to be suggesting that those who pass through this doorway are entering into the realm of the soul. The line that we've used to represent the descent of love also forms the vertical arm of a cross. Now, if we overlay a typical crucifix on our geometry, the connection between the two crosses begins to become clear. With his head at the midway point and the nail piercing his feet at the point representing humanity, we get a deepened significance of the inverted or down-pointing triangle. This vertical arm demonstrates a second phatic principle, as it is in a square root of three relationship to the horizontal arm when we get that arm a value of one. the numbers in this square root of 3 hierarchy are 1 in relationship to 1.732, which, just like the numbers forming the pi hierarchy, add to twice 7. We're looking at another hierarchy of energy and beings here, unknown to us, but functioning through the Fohatic principle of the square root of 3, just as those that we were told about in the secret doctrine function through pi. Again, we need to empower the geometry by emerging the meaning of the words in this second section with the specific Fohatic potency of this descending line. Now, there is corroborative evidence that supports the square root of 3 as an agent of Fohatic energy. This illustration reveals the angle between the apex and the baseline of the entire vesica piscis, a seemingly meaningless number, until we discover that this is the precise angle of the slope of the Great Pyramid of Giza, suggesting that it is extremely probable that the vesica piscis was the template used for its construction. In fact, I propose that the Egyptians were aware of the Fohatic nature of transrational functions and chose the square root of 3 as the energetic principle for the vertical axis of the Great Pyramid, since its interior spaces were designed not as tombs, but as chambers of initiations. It's interesting, too, to notice where these two chambers, the Queen's Chamber and the King's Chamber, when they're superimposed on the vesica piscis, just where they end up in the sevenfold structure, the King's Chamber pointing upward towards, you know, the highest subplanes of the mental plane. Okay. Where am I here? Okay. Interestingly, when the number 51 degrees and 51 minutes is divided by the square root of 3, you transpose minutes into the decimal system, I think it's 51.85. So when you divide that number by the square root of 3, which is 1.732, we get a sum that's just 6 thousandths less than 30, which numerologically reduces to 3. So, square root of 3 times square root of 3 is 3. That's the nature of a square root. And 51 degrees and 51 minutes divided by the square root of 3 also equals 3. This is a new discovery, at least new to me, about the pyramid. There's something intrinsic to in threeness in both the vesica piscis and the Great Pyramid. Certainly a guiding force in both. But let's get back to the Great Invocation. The third section reads, I'm getting lonely here. I don't even know if there's anybody out there. Even though this is short, could I get a volunteer to read this this third section?
No hands yet. Come on, people.
Wake up, somebody.
Okay, here we go. Iris, go ahead.
From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve.
Thank you. Thank you, Iris.
You're welcome.
We're told in a treatise on white magic that divine will and purpose are actually registered by humanity during this period of time through the agency of the mind, not the brain, but the mind, which is the higher mental. So this line, you'll see it on the left, connecting will and humanity, does not, indeed cannot, demonstrate the first ray transrational function. If you remember, we discussed this in a previous webinar, that though we can give it the symbol of infinity, it's not anything that we can actually apply as we can with the square roots and pi and phi. So it stands as a blind, holding the place for the unmanifest transrational function of the number one. Let's move on to the fourth section of the invocation. Another volunteer? I like this company. It's a much better way to go.
Oops. Okay, go ahead, Rick.
wait a second.
Is that Rick good?
Yeah, I'm here. I'll tell you what, I'll read it without plugging in my earphones.
Okay, that's all right.
From the center, which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells.
Thank you. This last line requires a new element in our geometry. The last line of what Rick just read, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Where do the potencies that can seal the door where evil dwells come from? Well, we've just been told, from the active or phohatic principles of love and light. In our geometric metaphor, these are phi, or the 1 plus the square root of 5 divided by 2 for light, and the square root of 3 for love. Now, if we extend the two lines representing these principles to the perimeter of a circle enclosing the entire Vesco Pisces, we can create a central point from the line representing the square root of 3 and a radius from the extension of the line representing phi. And if you think of this in subjective ways, that the center of the circle that would close the door where evil dwells would be the very center of that would be love. Love is what counters evil. But it's through intelligent activity that the circumference of that circle could actually be scribed. Okay? As before, we must synthesize the words and the geometry in order to begin to get a synthetic understanding of the symbol. Okay, now we come to the final summarizing section of the invocation. I'll read it. Let light and love and power restore the plan on Earth. So we'll use our enclosing circle to represent the Earth, since the four centers spoken of in the Great Invocation are all within our planet within our planetary hierarchy. Okay, we've done a lot of work with this, but this work is just really a preamble to our original intent, which is to have a non-sequential synthetic experience of the Great Invocation through the agency of, as DK says, a symbol of light and color. We have a symbol. Is it the actual Sinzar symbol used to represent the Great Invocation? Almost certainly not. Are phi and the square root of 3 the actual phohatic principles through which light and love become available to us? Well, though there is some supportive evidence, only one with the inner sight could know this for sure. Does this uncertainty as to the symbol's authenticity render it useless? In other words, have you been wasting your time for the last hour? I don't think so. If nothing else, the process of contemplating our symbol will stimulate the intuition and also allow us to begin the process of welding the meaning that substands words with a geometric form. Okay, the next step, and it's a huge step, must occur through contemplation. If you're interested in pursuing this, here's some possible techniques. By the way, this is the meditation for this month's webinar. Here, I'll bring it up. There it is. First, actually, this would be a great place to have a reader come in. Do we have another volunteer? Anybody like to read this meditation? I may interrupt you to comment as we go through it or not.
Anybody no volunteers would like to read yet. This? Come on, people.
Anybody?
Okay.
This is Bio here. Can I read it?
Yeah, please.
First, simply visualize this symbol as you see the great invocation while sequentially associating the geometry with the words. As you imagine the descending lines, try to feel the phoetic energy. Once you've linked words and geometry, after many meditations using this symbol, begin to fuse the geometry with the meaning that stands behind the words. When the geometry by itself evokes the full import of the words without sounding or even thinking those words, move on to the next section of the invocation. When you are able to evoke the synthetic meaning of every geometric element of the total symbol in sequence without any reference to the words, then begin combining the elements until you have a final synthesis.
Thank you. Any questions about this concept, about the symbol, or about the approach to basically moving from a sequential understanding of the great invocation to a synthetic one? Of course, you know, this work is infinitely easier to say than to do, and is in fact really in the nature of a Zen koan, as both are designed to invoke the intuition by breaking one's connection with the lower mind, right? Even if you just do step one, I think you'll discover non-sequential relationships between the various elements of the great invocation. That will, it'll enhance your understanding and give you greater insight into that, the meaning that stands behind the words. The whole point of this exercise has been to explore how symbols might be constructed in such a way that they represent a sequence of words, but promote a synthetic understanding. Okay. Well, we have more time left than I thought we would, which is extraordinary. We're always run over. So I think we're just going to have a bit shorter.
Here, you have a question.
Good. Yes.
Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Martin.
Do you know about Randall Carlson?
No, I don't.
You should. Everyone should. Just very briefly, when you put the image of the pyramid with the 51-51 angle, it reminded me that he has a fantastic series of videos on proving that the exact geometry of the Great Pyramid, if placed over the diameter of the Earth, is precise for the latitude and longitude of the position of the pyramid on the Earth. Mm. So I'll send that to you.
Well, that'd be terrific. Thanks
and
very much.
And I was thinking if we do the meditation, you could do all sorts of adaptations, such as just ponder on Christ being atop the whole thing, or ponder on the relationship of the earth to us as a human to Christ. All of those are variations.
Yes. And by the way, everyone, I'd love to hear, you know, any feedback that you get as a result of meditating on this, if you find it useful. Also, maybe another symbol will occur to you, or some modification of this symbol. You know, this isn't, this is just cast in mental substance. It's not cast in concrete. So I welcome a dialogue on the symbol and the ideas behind it, and also on if you have any knowledge of the what I'm calling these Fohatic principles, these the square roots and pi and phi, in relation to what I've been just talking about, because outside of this verse from the secret doctrine, there's precious little information that directly links these functions with esoteric considerations. So,
okay.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you.
We have another question, but first we have a comment here. Martin, will you please repeat the name that you just gave?
Oh, yes. That's Randall Carlson, Carlson. And he has a series of videos. He has a website on sacred geometry, and he's fantastic. YouTube has many videos, but I'll send it to Francis, and maybe he can make it known to everybody.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Great.
Go ahead, Orest.
Thanks, Martin. Hi, Orest.
Hello. My immediate response was that I tend to see things not in a pattern of two dimensions, but it's a three-dimensional thing. So to see this as a major sphere and then spheres within spheres and other shapes. So that's one interpretation.
It's really, it's not even other than this, because you could see this in a sense as a cross-section of what you're talking about. I also have looked at that. You have this very interesting seed-like shape that occurs in the middle of these two inner spheres, then surrounded by this this sphere. It would, I think, add to your insight to look at it that way. Yeah, thank you for that. Anyone else? Well, I have a reading list for you. Let's see. Oh, yeah, there's our final symbol. Here's the reading list. For those of you who'd like to draw, I recommend you start really getting into the 100-plus page book on called Sacred Geometry by Robert Lawler. These three pages doesn't seem like much until you actually get to those three pages. It'll take you some time to work your way through the exercises here, but it really adds a great understanding about this figure, if you're particularly interested in this figure. Some background info on the Great Invocation. I found it very helpful. Pages 141 to 170, and externalization of the hierarchy. Now, many of you may not actually own these books, but, as you may or probably know, you can find them online through lutustrust.org and read them there, especially a shorter segment like that. If you're going to read a whole book, I recommend you, spring for the copy. Let's see. The chapters on the number 3 in The Key to the Universe by Harriet Homer Curtis, and the same with The Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe by Michael Schneider. So I'd like to close with a meditation using this symbol. Let's bring it back up. Okay. All right, yeah, and I'd like to use this in conjunction with the great invocation. Michael Robbins, are you with us today? I don't believe you are. Are you there? No?
No, I don't think he is. I think it's me and Joe.
Okay. You're the two Michaels, yeah, the Michael clones for today. Okay. So I'll speak the great invocation. And as I do, I will move through the slides sequentially. And so let me get it back one point here. Here we go. To give you just some sense of how you would progress in your visualization for this. Okay. I'll open with an om just to set the tone. Om, from the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From that center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, well, that's it for today. Don't forget to donate a couple of bucks to the Moria Federation if you feel so moved. You can go on moriafederation.com. That just helps pay for this GoToMeeting program that all the webinar people use. And if, as I've said before, tell your friends about this webinar series. I'd love to fill the class. So, thank you for attending, and I'll see you next time, which will be on October 19th. Okay, well, bye for now.